Good morning, my name is Henry Nguyen from the University of Missouri. I chair the Ron Phillip Plant Genetic Lectureship Committee this year. The committee basically includes chair of four different divisions, C1, C7, C8, C9, and it's my turn to chair the committee this year. So it's an honor to be here this morning and chair the session this morning. The Ron Phillip Plant Genetic Lectureship was established in 2013. He named after Dr. Ron Phillips. Dr. Phillips is actually in the room and Judy. So Ron, I guess everybody knows you. Can you stand up to be recognized? Ron is a member of the National Academy of Science and past president of CSSA, and he also served the former chief scientist of the USDA, and certainly he's a great mentor to many graduate students and postdoc, you know, over his career. And I know one of the colleagues I work with, Roberto Tuberosa, been a long time colleague, and the lectureship was basically the reason the four divisions that I recognize, because those are the areas that Ron worked in during his career in plant genetic breeding and biotechnology. And so this year, the recipient of the lectureship, 2017 lectureship, Ron Phillip Plant Genetic Lectureship, go to Mark Sorrow, and today he will present the talk on plant breeding in the 21st century, molecular breeding and high throughput phenotyping. Mark is the distinguished professor of plant breeding and genetic at the plant genetic and plant breeding genetic section at Cornell University. He earned his bachelor and master degree in Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. It's a beautiful campus, Mark. I was there just last spring. And his PhD in plant genetic and breeding at University of Wisconsin, and among many, many accomplishments that Mark has achieved over the year. He's certainly the fellow of the Crop Science Society of America and many other awards. So without any further ado, I invite Mark to deliver the 2017 Ron Phillip Plant Genetic Lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Henry. It's really a great honor for me to be chosen to present this lecture. I've followed Ron's science throughout my career, and I've really enjoyed learning about the quality of his research, and he's been very inspirational. These are fantastic times to be a plant breeder. Technology is just almost overwhelming, but also very exciting, and it really makes us think on a daily basis about how we're approaching our discipline. Before I begin my presentation, I just wanted to mention something that I learned about Ron Phillip's work. I knew he was a postdoc at Cornell, and so I decided to see, what did Ron do at Cornell? It turns out that Ron published a high-throughput phenotyping method in 1967, but it was on Neurospora. His publication reported a white spore mutant that is useful for investigating genetic phenomena in Neurospora because the frequencies of the various tetrads can be determined quite easily. So Ron has been in high-throughput phenotyping way longer than I have. So today I'm going to talk about a few of our challenges as plant breeders, give you a brief overview of genomic selection, talk about some of the approaches that we have developed to understand G by E, integrate crop model into the genomic selection framework, and a little bit about some of the high-throughput phenotyping that we've been working on. Plant breeding is a predictive science driven by new technology and new knowledge. Essentially, everything we do as plant breeders is trying to predict something. Crop improvement began with the hunter-gatherers who clearly were very successful at domesticating our crop species, and clearly they had no knowledge of the underlying genetics controlling the traits they were selecting. Over time, plant breeders have not abandoned breeding methods, but instead they have adapted them to new technologies and integrated them into new breeding strategies. Breeders have developed family selection and progeny testing methods to increase heritabilities and gain from selection. But today, the focus is on tool development with an emphasis on molecular markers and how they can improve our breeding methodologies. Marker-assisted selection has evolved from QTL discovery to characterization of QTL cloning, functional markers, and more recently, association mapping. And complementary to marker-assisted selection is methodology known as genomic selection or genome-wide selection. And what's curious about this methodology is that we really don't have to understand the underlying genetic control of the traits that we're selecting. So it seems we may be back where the hunter-gatherers were thousands of years ago. Another example of new technology that's gaining acceptance is the adoption of aerial and ground-based phenotyping methods that generate secondary traits that we can use to improve the prediction accuracy of grain yield. So it's kind of interesting that Fisher's 1918 theory of infinitesimal variation is still applicable to plant breeding populations today. So some of our challenges are listed here. We know that some crops in some regions are approaching a yield plateau, and this is a big challenge for the breeders in those regions. We want better ways to connect genotype to phenotype so we can better predict the value of both qualitative and quantitative traits in our populations. I think plant breeders will always be struggling with genotype by environment interaction. So any technology that we can use to help us to understand and predict G by E and understand the genetic architecture of G by E is going to be quite valuable. We all know that we are experiencing climate change to varying degrees in different parts of the world, and we're experiencing more extreme weather events. This is a big, big problem for plant breeders, and we have to come up with creative ideas for dealing with this huge G by E. And finally, we need methods of phenotyping that generate information on a scale and a density and an accuracy comparable to DNA sequencing data with much reduced cost. But if we're going to meet these challenges, we have to embrace new technologies and adapt them to our breeding systems. Molecular breeding involves allele discovery, characterization, and validation. We then take that information to choose parents that have complementary superior alleles at different loci in order to effect transgressive segregation. This is a familiar breeder's equation that illustrates how we achieve gain from selection. We can increase our selection intensity. We can increase the accuracy of our selection. We can increase the genetic variation. But the factor that has the most impact on gain from selection is time. That's time per selection cycle. So if we can reduce that length of time between crossing and selection, we can increase our gain per unit time dramatically. So I'm sure a lot of you are very familiar with the genomic selection methodology, but for those of you that are not, I'll just quickly recap what genomic selection methodology involves. Typically, we think of genomic selection as involving two kinds of populations, a training population that is genotyped and phenotyped, and the genotypes have to have really good genome coverage because we're assuming that there's at least one or more markers in LD, linkage disequilibrium, with every QTL affecting the trait. We treat those genome-wide markers as random effects, and those effects are estimated simultaneously in a single model. Our prediction model attempts to capture the total additive genetic variation in controlling the trait, and we use those effects to estimate the breeding value of individuals in the population. The second population we refer to is a breeding or selection population. In this population, the individuals are genotyped, but not necessarily phenotyped. A genomic estimated breeding value is calculated for each individual by summing the marker effects, and then you can use that prediction model to effect multiple cycles of selection. So this figure illustrates how the two kinds of populations work together. We have the training population, which typically consists of elite breeding lines that have been evaluated in a target population of environments. And those genotypes and phenotypes are used to train your prediction model. And that prediction model is then used in combination with new genotypes, either from related germplasm or from your crossing program. And that generates the estimated breeding values, which you then use directly to select the best lines before you've phenotyped them, to either recycle in the crossing program or to advance into your advanced or regional testing programs. And eventually the best lines from that testing program get recycled in the training population. Models, there's been a lot of research done on what models work best for genomic selection. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on that today. But essentially, we have to use models that get around the problem of treating markers as fixed effects. When you treat markers as fixed effects, you treat them, you establish a significance threshold. And so when you do that, you're automatically overestimating the markers with large effects and not capturing those QTL with small effects. So we need methods that capture all of that genetic variation, and today we use linear mixed models, Bayesian models, machine learning, and we do not test for significance. We use the information from all of the markers, and all of the marker effects are treated as random effects and estimated simultaneously. There are a number of factors that have an effect on our prediction accuracy. That includes linkage disequilibrium, population size, marker platform model, but especially the relationship between the training population and the breeding population. That's because we need to have the correct phase, the correct marker effect, in order to have good prediction accuracy. And of course, just like for phenotypic selection, heritability has a major impact on your prediction accuracy. The first experiment that I'd like to describe is one that Nikola Heslow did a couple of years ago. He had a data set consisting of up to 1,000 barley, spring barley breeding lines and varieties grown in 58 environments throughout Europe. And the data set was highly unbalanced. There were only 18 genotypes that even were present in 50% of the environments. So it was highly unbalanced. He used the Bayesian lasso model in order to generate marker effects for each of the varieties in each of the environments. The goal was to identify outlier environments and group relevant mega environments. Okay, this figure is a heat map. One of the paradigm shifts in this study was that instead of having an unbalanced genotype data set, you can use the marker effects to create a balanced data set. That's because the marker effects were estimated in every single environment. And this allows you to estimate the relationship among those environments using something like Euclidean distances, and then those can be plotted in a phylogenetic tree. And that phylogenetic tree is represented in this heat map, where the dissimilar environments are in pink and red, and the most similar environments are in blue. And you can see that there's a clear pattern of environments that
have that create similar mark effects in other environments that are very dissimilar and they're outliers. But when we group these into clusters, we did not see an improvement in the genomic selection prediction accuracy. So while this is an interesting tool for looking at the relationships among environments, it's not, in this study, it was not beneficial for improving the prediction accuracy. This figure shows the a heat map of the reciprocal prediction accuracy among those environments. So each pairwise combination of environments was used to predict the marker effects in the other environment. So when we did this, you can see that the pattern is not nearly as clear as it was with marker effects. But when we grouped this into six groups, we saw a significant improvement in the genomic selection prediction accuracy. So using the reciprocal prediction accuracy had an impact on the overall prediction accuracy in this population. In another experiment that Nikola Heslo did, the goal was to find the optimum set of environments in the total population of environments that you have data from. So here he tried to optimize the composition of the training population. For this experiment, he first started by computing the mean accuracy of each environment with all of the others. So environment one was used to predict the prediction accuracy in the other 57 environments. Then those prediction accuracies were ranked from the lowest to the highest, and then removed one at a time, starting with the least predictive environment. And that was put into the unpredictive set, and then the genomic prediction model was retrained on the remaining environments. So this figure shows the results of that experiment. The red dots are the predictive set, and those were removed one at a time and put into the unpredictive set in blue, and then the model was retrained, and he saw an increase in prediction accuracy from 0.54 to 0.61, which was statistically significant, after the removal of about 18 or 19 environments. And in the unpredictive set, down here at the bottom, you saw a slight increase in accuracy in the beginning, but then it plateaued up to about the same place as the predictive set. And so the remaining 40 environments were referred to as the optimum training population. In a validation set in the following year, in the green squares, he saw a similar pattern, but that increase in efficiency and accuracy was not statistically significant. Another project that Nikola worked on was trying to figure out a way to improve prediction accuracy by including environmental factors in the prediction model. So for this, the goals were to integrate environmental data and crop modeling into the genomic selection framework to predict genotype by environment interaction and increase prediction accuracy. Genome-wide markers and their response to the environment was used to understand the genetic architecture of the G by E. For this data set, there were 2,400 elite lines grown in 44 environments over 6 years throughout France. And a SNP platform was used with 1,287 SNP markers. The weather data was from AgriForecast, a European-wide data set that interpolates weather on a 25-kilometer grid. And the wheat model that he used in this study was a model called Sirius Quality. So the crop model was then used to compute the phenology for varieties that had different maturities. Obviously, when you're aligning weather data to developmental stages, you have to synchronize early, late, and medium maturing varieties. Otherwise, the weather data doesn't mean anything. So that was the first step. Then environmental stress covariates were developed by stage using information from the literature about the sensitivity of different growth stages to different environmental stresses. From this, he adopted 101 stress covariates, and these are really just climatic variables at different stages of development. And of course, these were synchronized according to maturity of each variety. These stress covariates were then used as independent variables in the statistical models. So he used a factorial regression model, and for each marker, he fit a main effect and a sensitivity to each of those stress covariates. So each environmental measure was used to determine what the marker effect was for that covariate. The 44 environments were split with 22 for training and 22 for validation. And a machine learning algorithm called soft rule fit was used to try to capture the interaction between the markers and the stress covariates. So the performance was predicted as a main effect plus a G by E deviation. So for studies like this, you run into problems with computational capacity because you end up trying to use a lot of markers to predict a lot of effects. And in this case, we had 1,287 marker effects times 101 environmental covariates, and this was not feasible to compute in our computing environment. We decided to look at the variance of the marker effects over environments, and many of the markers had little or no variance, so those were eliminated. And what one of the interesting things we noticed is that the photoperiod sensitivity gene, PPDD1, had the highest variance of all of the markers, but alone it was not statistically significant. So we used that approach to reduce the number of markers, and we ended up with an optimum number of markers of 250. This figure shows the prediction accuracy with different numbers of markers. And included in this model was the soft rule fit machine learning algorithm for G by E. This table shows a list of some of the environmental covariates that were used that were most significant in this study. The most important one was the sum of the average daily temperature between meiosis and flowering. And of course, as you've probably seen in other presentations here at this meeting, heat during meiosis can cause partial sterility. The next most important was drought in the early spring, measured by two different environmental covariates. And then that was followed by heat stress before flowering and heat stress during early grain fill. One of the things you can do when you have a prediction model that allows you to predict G by E is you can predict G by E for any genotype given related genotypes and related environments. So we can use a balanced set of predicted G by E effects to cluster these environments. So in this study, the environments were mainly grouped by year, as you might guess, but there was also a very strong north-south trend. So the northern environments tended to group together and the southern environments tended to group together. The nice thing about this is that it allows you to predict the genotype by environment interaction for a genotype that was not tested in a particular environment. This figure shows the relationship in the prediction accuracy between the environment's prediction accuracy with G by E versus those without G by E. And what you can see is that for most of the environments, above the line showed that including G by E in the model was useful for improving the prediction accuracy. Another thing you might notice here is that the environments down here at the bottom were the ones that benefited the most from including G by E in the model. We saw an overall 11% increase in mean prediction accuracy and a 10.8% decrease in the coefficient of variability. So this approach allows you to understand what environmental stresses are important in your target population of environments. You can reduce the dimensionality and non-linearity, and it allows us to plan for the future. If we know, if we have some idea of what to expect in our environments, we can try to select genotypes that address those new stresses that might come along. So to summarize, the prediction model is able to predict some of the G by E response in unobserved environments. It was statistically significant. The crop growth model is effective in condensing thousands and thousands of environmental variables into some relevant covariates. And the model with G by A provides improved statistical accuracy, and by combining the crop model with genomic selection, we can predict genotype performance in environments of interest, those hopefully that we can predict for the future. So this gives us some insight into the genetic, the genotype by environment interaction genetic architecture. Another student who did her PhD with me is Jessica Rakowski. Jessica is now a bioinformatics person in the Philippines, working for ERIE. In her project, she used genomic recurrent selection and phenotypic recurrent selection to evaluate the efficacy of using genomic selection for improving adult plant stem rust resistance to the race UG99. For those of you that are not familiar with this stem rust race, it's an unusually virulent race of stem rust that has spread throughout Africa and into Yemen and Iran. So it's a major hazard. And so our goal here in this project was to try to develop adult plant resistance to this stem rust race that would be insensitive to multiple stem rust races. So for this project, we had a historical data set from Njoro, Kenya, 373 Simut breeding lines, and the line mean basis was for heritability was 0.82. We had this population evaluated for major stem rust genes because that's going to mess up your adult plant resistance scoring. So Matt Rouse did this for us at the Cereal Disease Laboratory in Minnesota. The percent of the total genotypic variance was mainly genotype and environment, so there was very little G by E. And so, as I mentioned before, we did two cycles of genomic selection at the same amount of time that we did one cycle of phenotypic selection. And these were all evaluated then in both Kenya and Ethiopia. The historical data set was used to select 14 parents, and these 14 parents were not necessarily selected for stem rust resistance. They were mainly selected for agronomic performance. And those were intermated for two generations, and then the population was divided into two replicates for both phenotypic and genomic selection. We used about 18,000 GBS markers with less than 20% missing data. This principal component analysis shows you the relationship between the historical population of 373 in black and the intermated population that is the new population that we made selections from based on our model. And also in blue, the parents you can see are pretty widely scattered throughout the principal component figure. Okay, so we wanted to find out how well the historical population predicted stem rust resistance compared to the early generation population. So we took the data from the early generation population and from the historical population, and we selected different training set sizes using the mean coefficient of determination published by Rinsen et al. And when we did that, we found that the prediction accuracy historical population pretty much continued linearly up to the total population size. But when we looked at the early generation population, it was always more accurate. That's because it's more closely related to your selection population. But we saw that it started to plateau up here around 250 individuals, and that's because the prediction accuracy is starting to plateau in a closely related population. This shows the outcome from evaluating the cycle 2 genomic selection population and the single cycle of phenotypic selection in both Kenya and Ethiopia, and for the two replicates. And so in REP 1, phenotypic realized gain was greater than the genomic selection, but in REP 2, genomic selection realized gain was greater than the phenotypic selection. So overall, the difference was non-significant. This shows that same data in a line graph form. And what you can see here in this figure is that there's a change in the slope when we trained the population based on the early generation population in after that first cycle of selection. So this highlights the importance of using a closely related breeding population for your selection. Interestingly, the STEMRA scores were between Ethiopia and Kenya were correlated at 0.66. So this and the STEMRA's race in Ethiopia was quite different. So we think that this is giving us decent horizontal resistance across multiple races. The downside of this experiment was that there was a lot more inbreeding in the genomic selection population. And this is partly because the gain from selection is faster, but this means that you're also inbreeding faster, and the genomic selection model cannot take advantage of mutations and new recombinants until you retrain the model. So you have to retrain your genomic selection model fairly frequently in order to capture that new genetic variation. Next, I'd like to turn to some work that we've been doing on high-throughput phenotyping. This is in this slide. I'm summarizing the pluses and minuses of classic phenotyping and field-based phenotyping. Classic phenotyping is time-intensive. It generates fairly limited amount of data. It's labor-intensive, and sometimes phenotypers can introduce bias by accident because they're often visually scored. With field-based high-throughput phenotyping, generally it requires less effort. You collect a lot more data over many time points. There's less trait bias, and over time, if you can amortize the cost of the equipment, it's actually cheaper. This figure shows one of Mike Gore's ground-based phenotyping machines that he developed at Maricopa, Arizona. It has a crop circle sensor for gathering NDVI data. It has thermal sensors for canopy temperature and a ultrasonic transducer for plant height. And then it also has a GPS, high accuracy GPS system and data loggers to collect the data. This is another ground-based system from the University of Hohenheim called Breed Vision. It's well equipped with many different kinds of sensors. We've been doing phenotyping, aerial phenotyping, for the last 3 years at Cornell, and we just have some preliminary analyses at this point in time, but Margaret Krause is the graduate student working on this project. And the goal here was to improve our prediction accuracy for wheat grain yield and other agronomic traits. Some of you may not be familiar with NDVI. It's an abbreviation for Normalized Difference Vegetation Index. And the traditional NDVI is just simply calculated using the ratio of near-infrared reflectance minus red reflectance over near-infrared reflectance plus red reflectance. And when you do this, what happens is because the healthy plants have a much lower red reflectance, they have a much higher NDVI, and the stressed plants have a lower NDVI. In our studies, we've been using GNDVI, and for this, we use a narrower spectrum. And instead of the whole red spectrum, we just use the green spectrum from 540 to 570. And this is believed to be a little bit more sensitive to chlorophyll concentration. Okay, so we used the airplane for the first 2 years and a drone for the last year. They both have advantages and disadvantages. The drone has a payload limitation, but the airplane has difficulties flying low enough and slow enough to get good resolution images. They're both affected by weather conditions and, of course, FAA regulations. We flew 6 dates. Actually, we flew 2 dates in May instead of one. And our April flight was to capture winter survival in the winter grains. This shows an orthomosaic of one of our fields. And in this field, you can see a lot of variation in the color. This is in April, so it's reflecting winter survival. Winter survival was probably the trait that was easiest to predict based on ground truthing data. You can see that there are plots that winter killed. Over here we have a couple of elite wheat breeding trials that have very well adapted, good winter hardiness. Down here we have a barley nursery. Winter barley is not as winter hardy as winter wheat, and you can see there's a lot more winter kill down here. This is an NDVI image of the same field, and of course it's harder to interpret with our eyes, but this is what gives us the interesting and useful data for trying to predict various traits. One of the first things that Margaret noticed was that there's a difference in the NDVI, GNDVI, for that reflected canopy architecture. And in this case, the upright leaves of some of the varieties in our trial had a much higher GNDVI compared to the curved or floppy-leaved varieties. So this means that more of the light was penetrating the erect leaf canopy. What was even more interesting was that there was a modest correlation with yield with the upright leaf habit. So this taught the breeder, that's me, something about what I should be selecting out there in my nursery. One of the things you might expect is that the correlations between GNDVI and these different traits vary across time and location. So we can see that in some cases, for some locations, the correlation was pretty consistent, whereas for other locations, it went from positive or negative to positive over time. And so this is an important thing to keep in mind, and you need to use this information to optimize the collection times and the prediction models. Another project that Margaret is working on is a collaboration with CIMMYT, primarily Matt Reynolds' group. And in this project, they're using a A-series microhyperspectral camera. And the goal here is to use these reflectance phenotypes to improve prediction accuracy for grain yield. The data set consisted of 790 wheat lines run in four environments with 4,000 markers. The camera was able to record reflectance across 250 different wavelengths. And then the mixed models were fit using spectral reflectance, pedigree, and genotypes. Only 62 of those bands proved to be reliable and useful for the prediction model. And this figure here shows the correlation between grain yield and reflectance for different wavelengths over the entire spectrum. Grown, and this was six different flights. The heritability for both grain yield and the spectra were pretty good, ranging from 0.4 to 0.6. When we looked at the prediction accuracy for the different flights, we found that they did vary quite a bit with different environments. Most of the environments, when you included all of the data across all flights, we got better prediction accuracy, but not all. And in every case, the hyperspectral data was more predictive than either pedigree or genotype. Same with the heat environment. But in a drought environment, the last two flights gave a slightly higher prediction accuracy than when we used all the data. And this is probably because that's when you're starting to see really big differences in the varieties, that late in that growing season. So where are we going to go with genomic prediction? I think we're still just scratching the surface of how to use this technology. We have a lot to learn yet. But we need to fit the breeding method to the genetic architecture, the trait of interest. Different breeding programs, every breeding program is different, no matter where they are or what crop they're working on. And that means that each breeder is going to have to figure out how to optimize the use of genomic selection in their program. We can use high-throughput phenotyping traits to improve our prediction accuracies, and we can combine association analysis and crop modeling with genomic prediction to try to better understand the genetic architecture as well as better understand phenotype-environment interaction. I just want to end with a technology that I'm sure you've all heard a lot about, but I think this is a very, very important new technology that breeders need to adopt as soon as possible. It's pretty demanding technology because you have to use transformation, you have to understand, you have to have genome sequences, you have to understand a little bit about the genetic architecture of different traits, but it has many potential applications. You can generate indels, replace sequences, label sequences, you can modulate gene expression. And although we've started our own gene editing project, I don't have data to show you today, but I wanted to highlight a recent publication I think is very interesting. This is a project out of the Lippmann Lab, published by Rodriguez Leal et al. In Cell very recently, and it's titled Engineering Quantitative Trait Variation for Crop Improvement by Genome Editing. And in this study, what they did was they used multiple guide RNAs targeting promoter regions in three productivity traits in tomato. Those three traits were locule number, inflorescence branching, and plant architecture. Remember, they're targeting the promoter regions. This slide shows you the three traits. The top row of figures is the variation, the range in variation that they saw in locule number, which is, of course, related to fruit size. The second row of pictures is the inflorescence branching, and it shows quite a range in amount of branching bearing flowers. And then the bottom is the self-pruning gene, which changes the plant architecture, and it changes the number of leaves between flowering nodes. So they've used this genome editing approach to generate a continuum of variation. What's interesting is that they were unable to predict phenotypic effects based on the allele type or transcription change. Finally, it looks like that this approach could be very useful, very interesting for improving yield traits. So I think this is a technology that we need to very carefully consider and see how we might be able to implement in our own breeding programs. Just to wrap up, I just want to emphasize something that Ed Buckler said yesterday in his presidential talk at the Crop Science Breakfast. The days are long gone when a plant breeder can develop a variety alone. It requires a team, a big team, and that's because our discipline is complex and becoming more complex by the day, it seems like. We need to be able to be effective collaborators with a number of people with expertise that is complementary to ours. And this includes a whole range of people, from economists to statisticians, entomologists, plant pathologists, and believe it or not, even administrators. So it behooves us to try to build a team around our programs. And the people in the companies, they know this already. But I think historically, a lot of public breeders have tried to do this on their own. It's not going to be feasible in the future. Just wrap up with acknowledgement of some of our sponsors, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The USDA has been tremendous. Lima Grain provided support for Nicola Heslow. And I especially need to recognize my small grains breeding technician team, Venture, Tanaka, Fox, and Chavez. We have a great Cornell Cooperative Extension team, Bergstrom, Stanyard, Gano, and others, that are very important for getting the word out to farmers and companies. I'll stop there, and I'd like to try to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Mark, you talked about Lima Grain data. It's a lot of data locations that they have available to them. Do you think that the uniform nurseries, which have a historical data set, would be something that would be useful to us as we think about some of the technology that they're talking about?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. The question is, do I think that some of the uniform nurseries that have been going on for decades might have some useful data? Yeah, I think there is some potential there, Joe. John Lukianik has used the uniform mid-season oat performance nursery data for some of their work. That was mainly for beta-glucan. And you might remember the Osoro et al. Paper and the Franco et al. Paper. Clearly, that has some value, and I think somebody should think about how to mine that. Now, remember too, you got to have genotypes, and the question is, can you get genotypes from some of that historical data? I think that's the key. Yeah.
Good. In your example with the Krakowski, is it fair to say that the genomic selection was as good as phenotypic selection, but less work?
Well, that's a tough question. The question is it fair to say that the genomic selection was as effective as phenotypic selection, but less work? Well, you only did half the work for the phenotype because you only did one generation of selection. In the case of rust, it's fairly easy to phenotype. And also, we did two cycles of intermating with the genomic selection versus just one cycle with the phenotypic selection. So I'd say overall there was more work in the genomic selection side of the project than in the phenotypic side of the selection project. Yep. Roberto.
Yeah, great talk, Mark. Rather so you pointed out the time of the limiting factor, and I fully agree you should embrace editing, but to do editing we need the sequence.
Yeah.
For quantitative traits. And perhaps it's a coincidence, like if you look at the CAP project, that's pretty much a QTL cloning exercise.
So the question is not a question. He asked if I would comment. Can I comment on the use of genome editing mainly for quantitative variation? Right? Is that accurate? Okay. Keep in mind that tomato experiment was using single genes. These were qualitative genes that they used to generate quantitative variation. Qualitative genes to generate quantitative variation. In the case of the wheat cap, yes, we are trying to clone yield component QTL. And I think maybe I shouldn't speak for George Dukowski, but I think his vision is that once we've got the genes cloned for these QTL, the goal is to look at the allelic variation to see what we can find that might be effectively combined in novel genotypes that could improve improve yield. So I think that's kind of the vision. But don't hold me to that. George would probably kick me on that one. Yeah. Yeah. To you.
Sir, when we use the GPS data for the genomic prediction selection, could you tell me use raw GPS data or imputed GPS data? And also the second question is how deep we need to do the sequence for the training population and breeding population?
I got the first question, which was, can I comment on how we manage the GBS data for genomic prediction? And our standard protocol is to first filter for 50% missing data and minor allele frequency, and then we impute using either maximum likelihood expectation or random forest, and this generates a pretty darn robust GBS data set. And I think the second question was something about GBS in the training population versus the selection population. How deep the sequence? Generally, if you have some very good sequence data on parents and or the training population, you can use fairly low density in the selection population. Because the selection population is going to have high LD in most cases. The LD in the training population is probably going to be a little bit lower, but we find that the selection population has pretty high LD, so you don't have to worry quite so much about marker density there. Yeah, Don?
Yeah, Mark, you said at the beginning of your talk, I guess, that reading was more exciting and growing.
Well, I think because of all the changes in our discipline, that especially with the new technologies and the new knowledge, genome sequences, on and on, that it makes it a very, very exciting discipline to come into. And maybe you disagree, but
No, I completely agree.
But I think
the question that I'm coming to is how do we look at the future of the discipline of plant breeding?
How do we look at the future of the discipline of plant breeding? Well,
does it change in how we define it? Who is a plant breeder? How do we teach it? What does it encompass?
Maybe we need to have this discussion over a beer. But the number of people at Cornell, undergraduates I'm talking about, that want to get into plant breeding is growing. Among the plant sciences, it's the most popular concentration now in the undergraduate discipline.
So, are there going to be plant breeding jobs for those people, or are they going to just go into all kinds of things?
Well, I'm pretty optimistic, but I think that if plant breeders can effectively work towards solving food security issues and feeding the population, I think it's going to grow in stature, and there's going to be more investment. I think I'm pretty optimistic at this point in time. Of course, I don't have that many years left, but yeah. Dave?
Does the genomic selection tools need to encompass things to make sure you don't cap out genetic variability and maybe even use ways to enhance or maintain the genetic variability?
Yes. Do we need to use methodologies to minimize the inbreeding, essentially? Is that your question? Yes, we absolutely do, and there's at least a couple of methods that have been published in the literature on how to do this. You can build it into a selection index. You can overweight minor alleles, because when you increase the frequency of minor alleles, that increases the genetic variance. You can include a diversity index. So, yeah, there are ways, but I think it's critical. I think you have to use something in your prediction models that will minimize the inbreeding. Yeah, absolutely. No. Yeah.
Have you seen that in your plant breeding herds?
Well, you know, I've never tested that hypothesis. Yeah, but I can't.
In general, would you say that generally tends to be true?
I don't have an answer to that question, believe it or not, but I scored, okay, so Margaret was in at Summit this year, so I scored Leaf Habit myself this year. And we haven't analyzed that data yet, but I think this helps a breeder to train their eye for what to look for. And I can't look at a plot and say this is high yield, this is medium yield, this is low yield. I can identify the low yield ones, obviously, but when you're up in that 10-20%, you can't see yield. And so knowing what plant characteristics are correlated with yield can help the breeder to, I think, develop an eye for those more heritable traits. Yeah, I think that I thought it was pretty cool that she even discovered this, because I've never selected for Leaf Habit in my 40 years at Cornell. It's just I just select for agronomic traits, lodging resistance, yield, test weight, etc. Tough question. The question is, we need a team approach, but when somebody takes a job where there's very few people and working on a crop, what would be my advice? Get a lot of graduate students.
Changing crops,
yeah. Way in the back.
I have a question following that last question you asked. When you get a new grad student, right, Nico Kessler, and he worked on the crop model, the genetics, genomic prediction, now you got a migrant work on this phenotype as well. And then this whole area, then how do you actually help them quickly adapt to a new area that, gain a new impact for your family and program?
I think if I understand your question is how do I help new graduate students adapt and learn the new technologies? I find that my graduate students are very good at teaching each other. I make sure that they do a lot of reading of the literature. Each graduate student in plant breeding at Cornell gives 15-minute presentations in the fall and the spring so that everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And that allows them to tap into the technology that some other graduate student has been working on. And of course, we have our weekly plant breeding seminars, which is very good for learning about what other people are doing. So it's kind of a learning opportunity that the good students really take advantage of. They learn from other students, and we have a good curriculum at Cornell too. It covers most of the bases related to plant breeding. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of the way I see it.
So if you get a new grad student, you have to help them when you learn the technology part of the genomic selection.
Yeah, if that's part of their project. Of course, every graduate student has a little bit different project, and not all of them work on crop models. But I think that the methodology that Nicola developed with the crop models is pretty straightforward. It's actually not too awfully complicated, as long as you know how to generate the environmental covariates that you want to use in your model. If you can do that, then it's pretty much straightforward after that. Maria? Yeah, the question is, with our models, are we capturing the additive variants only, or are we capturing some of the non-additive genetic variation? And it depends on the population that we're using. If we're using pure lines to capture genotypic effects in pure lines, then obviously something like RKHS or Random Forest that has the capability of capturing some of that non-additive gene action is something we always do. In terms of selecting parents for crossing, I think additive models like GBLUP are totally okay. we oftentimes do see a slight bump in prediction accuracy using RKHS. So I think it's a really, I think it's really, really important that when you're testing models, that you test at least two or three different models, because it's hard to predict which one's the best.
Okay, thank you. Before we adjourn, if you bear with me just for a second, I will call up Dr. Ron Phillips, and I need to present this practical certificate to Dr. Maxwell.